Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Tax Mash Show with Nathan Ross and my associate Dan DeBose. And this week we're going to be talking about a couple of newsworthy items, and then we'll get into the concept of using a trust entity to accomplish several things within your planning. And whether you're investing in single family, multifamily, or I guess other assorted assets. Our focus tends to be, as you know from listening to the show, the multifamily projects, what we call REPs, real estate private partnership syndications. And it's always interesting to hear others talk about these investment types on the air. I know the show that was on just before ours today, this week and last week, have been discussing syndicated multifamily investments, and it's always interesting listening to non-tax people discuss tax concepts on real estate. We'll circle back and talk about that here in a moment, but we want to remind you before we get started that just because you listen to the show today, doesn't mean that you should run out and try to implement any of the strategies or projects, etc., that we may reference. And always consult with your existing advisors, be it legal, tax, real estate, investment advisors, etc., before you undertake any specific strategy to make sure that they agree that what you heard is what you think you heard, because oftentimes we talk about general rules, or we may talk about exceptions to the general rule, one of which, or both of which, or neither of which might apply to your specific facts and circumstances. So we take great care in dispensing this information, and we do it as carefully as we know how. But that said, again, it may not fit what you're trying to accomplish. If you don't have advisors that understand these strategies, feel free to go to the BAPlanner.com website. That's BEAPLANNER.com. And you can complete our intake forms there. You'll see a link at the top right, along with a schedule, a call link as well, right next to it. Dan and I are happy to take some time to discuss your special facts and circumstances on the phone and tell you how we might be able to sync up with your objectives. Dan, are you on? I haven't heard you say hi yet. Why don't we hear your voice?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I haven't had a chance to say hi.
I was getting ready to say, and I guess I should have ended that by saying I really didn't give you the chance. But anyway, we're glad to have you back this week. And Dan, the first thing that I want to talk about is, well, a lot of today's show, most of today's show, will be discussing inflation and its impact on real estate investors. And the first thing, and this is a fairly simple and straightforward article, but I like some things that are mentioned that you can kind of read through, look through the lines and see some things that might not be apparent or readily apparent to the tenant involved. The article is about the tenant, but I think it's telling for those of us that are in the real estate private partnership investment space. And by the way, I don't say it often on the air, but I guess I should, that Dan DeBose and Nathan Ross collectively have either built, reported on, drafted operating agreements, partnership agreements for, and invested in, reviewed also for clients, and or invested in several $1 billion worth of multifamily projects. We know whereof we speak is the bottom line. And each of those angles is a different, you know, window into the same room. But the bottom line is we understand this asset class. We understand what it takes to be successful in it as an investor. And we understand where the threats are to investors. And so when I see a general article in the Houston Chronicle that talks about a couple or three different people's quest to find a more affordable apartment to rent in view of the fact that rents are going up. How much did you note, Dan, in the article?
Houston area, 13% increases since 2019 is what I'm reading.
Yeah, and there's one, right there at the top of the article, a young lady that, I'm not sure she's young, 16% was the net rent increase on her Northwest Houston apartment, and I can't remember if it said over what time frame. I did see the 12% since 2019. So there are, it's across the board, but the bottom line is the rents are going up more than anybody would like. And, you know, as the article said, in many Houston neighborhoods, the days of a one-bedroom apartment for $1,000 are long gone. And I would echo those comments. Looking at it from the other perspective, where we're representing investors and trying to help them understand the math behind prospective investments. And so we're not telling people what they should or should not invest in, but we look at the math within the private placement memorandum, the operating agreement. It could be the investment webinar or seminar that most syndicators or lead partners will provide. And we try to help them understand whether the assumptions are normally rational, you might say. Is it likely that rents might go up 20 or 25% in the next year and a half or 2 years, which we see a lot in pro forma information? And right now, with inflation doing what it is, I guess that assumption probably is fairly rational, right, Dan? I mean, it's not as hard when you've got inflation spurring the increase.
When you got that 8%, 8.3% pushing it behind, you know, it's hoping to get it down to 2% by the end of this year, but that's a rather hopeful assumption, I believe. We're only 3 months left.
Yeah, it's kind of like having a strong tailwind as you're coming back across the Pacific. If you're flying, right? I'll never forget, I was on a flight once from Thailand back to the U.S. Actually, it was from Tokyo. It was after I'd landed and transited through the airport and got on the flight from Tokyo to Houston. And the normal 13-hour flight took like 10 hours and 15 minutes. And even the pilot expressed surprise that it could could be that quick. I mean, that's a pretty big discount off of the norm. But bottom line is that's kind of the same scenario with inflation. It's not hard to see these kind of rent increases when you've got the market driving it. Now, it's not a true, and that's what we focus on, is what's the net benefit, because your costs are going up. It's not just your rents, and so it's kind of a faux rent increase, right, Dan? So
you're talking about to the owner of the property, yeah.
Right, that's right.
That's he may be staying even.
Yeah, there was a comment, though, that I've used many times in this article, and they say it a little bit differently. I say there's not many fish swimming in the pond of 20 to 25% rent increases that can afford to pay those just because you put, quote, wood-like flooring in and replace appliances and put the bark park in and, you know, maybe some covered parking. That doesn't mean the people that are in that property now paying, let's say 1,200 are going to be able to afford 1,500, 1,600. We're talking about workforce housing is the term for many of these properties, the type that are were paying 800 or 900 a month, and now they're seeing their rents go up to 11 and 1,200, and so they're looking. I mean, they're shopping. The thing that I find remarkable, or not necessarily remarkable, but I find it very telling, is whose income is keeping pace with these increases. Do you know a whole lot of people, Dan, that have gone from 12%, 13% in the last couple years? I mean, that's not all that common. I mean, I know it happens, and I know people are moving, switching jobs, et cetera, but that's a pretty big increase to keep up with in terms of the income. So.
Yeah, somebody maybe like their job. They don't want to change jobs. They're going to get that 10 or 12% without, or 25% as it may be in some cases with these rent increases. I mean, it's an awful thing when you look at going from an $800 a month to possibly $1,100, or that $900 to $1,200. I mean, that's 25, 30% increases in rent. Who can afford that on the salaries or the payroll they may have? It's in the working class you're talking about, the one you just mentioned, you know, the fact that these are probably more like in the Class B, Class C arena, I guess I could say.
Yeah.
Is that possible they could really go up that much? That's just amazing to me.
Well, it's even to a point where I know one of the folks they mentioned in the article had decided to move to, where was it, Iowa? It was somewhere in the Midwest, because they could not make the numbers work, staying in Houston. So, I think that's probably something that, while it occurs, it's not anywhere near the norm, but that's the desperation, or that's the level of desperation that people are going to. And this, I think, the White House, the current occupants of the White House are oblivious to how hard it is for the average American to keep up with inflation that's rising. You know, most things in the consumer price index are rising faster than the underlying paychecks of the folks that mentioned it. And, you know, there's a line in this article says pressures are only expected to build on renters as consumer prices, including rents, continue rising faster than their paychecks. And a survey of 1.1 million renters in Houston, almost 41% reported relying on credit cards to make ends meet, and nearly 40% were borrowing money from family, et cetera. I saw another article or stat yesterday that I believe it was in this past quarter. It certainly was no longer, I think, that $7 trillion of value had been wiped out of the American family's collective net worth. That's a lot of money. That's crazy. I don't know that I've ever seen. That's got to be some sort of high water mark, wouldn't you think, Dan?
I surely would. You know, that's $7 trillion. That's a quarter of the national deficit.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And that wipes out a lot of reserves.
Gone.
And yeah, that's right. And, of course, I guess the market could come back. I mean, that probably included – up through the latest news this week, where the market dipped below the third, or the, at least the NYSE, I think, dipped below 30,000. Yeah, a mark
went below 30,000.
Yeah, that's pretty telling as well. We've got another article I wanted to mention that is specifically about, I guess it's more attuned to the owner side in this apartment space, but generally, the discussion involves the loss of purchasing power on behalf of the consumer, because that's what drives the ability to pay rent. So the folks like us that own apartment units, and they talk about the consumer price index as being a measure of inflation that's representative of the average consumer. And of course, what does Nathan say about averages? None of us are average. We're all actual. So this isn't necessarily reflective of you. You may be worse off, or you may be better off. But in any event, as we all know, if we listen to the news over the last 12 months, well, I say as you listen to the news, that's not true. If you listen to the White House, you would think that everything has turned a corner. It's all coming back down. Just because it didn't go up much, that's considered a major victory. We'll see about that as we get towards the end of the year. Let's see if the Fed is still executing the QT, as it were, in the face of what at that point should be a full-on recession if it continues raising rates like it has. But in any event, over the last 12 months, ended August of 2022, CPI inflation increased by 8.3%. A rate that far outpaces the Federal Reserve's average target of 2% per year. There are many contributing factors to inflation as we're experiencing today, but the primary drivers are the Fed Reserve's response to COVID, supply chain disruptions, tight labor, and volatile energy prices. And appreciation of real estate has no doubt played a large part of inflation as well. And let me find a good example of that. One of my associates down in South Texas sent me a message this week. Dan, I don't think I shared this with you as of yet, but if you secured a 30-year fixed mortgage on a $600,000 home at a 2.6% interest rate in 2021, this isn't long ago, folks, this is last year, you have the same monthly mortgage payment as someone that just bought a $392,000 home. What is that, about 50% less, Dan? Depending on which way you make that calculation.
It's almost 40% less.
Yeah. So you'd have the same monthly payment as someone that just bought a $392,000 home at today's 6.2 interest rate. Think about that for a minute. That's a massive difference in terms of what your purchasing power is. I think that illustrates the point that the Realty Mogul article here. Realty Mogul is a syndication platform. You may recall that I pointed out a few weeks ago that Self-Made Millionaires platform here in Houston, the most prolific investor mentor of all time in that organization. And by the way, I didn't hear the gentleman on the show before ours today acknowledge that you could invest directly with that prolific investor without ever joining Self-Made Millionaires platform. They don't tell you that. Just something to keep in mind if you're accredited under the 506 rules, that you really don't need to be paying Self-Made Millionaires platform $20,000 to get the good stuff. You can go right around them and get the good stuff out on Realty Mogul or CrowdStreet, et cetera. But specifically, that gentleman, who's an incredible real estate investor operator, is doing transactions out on Realty Mogul, breaking all the rules of Self-Made Millionaires platform. For some reason, it's okay when you go out there and do it, but don't think about doing that when you're raising money inside Self-Made Millionaires platform. And, of course, the gentleman that was trying to talk about tax issues in the context of struggling to talk about tax issues in the context of private placements probably doesn't have a clue that someone he holds in such esteem is out there breaking all the rules of that group. Now, the rules he's breaking are not being broken. It's just there's greener pastures for those that syndicate. And if you're a syndicator within Self-Made Millionaires platform, and there's probably about 300, 350, based on what I know, having been around that group for a long time, why in the world would you have the handcuffs on? Once you reach a certain level, you build your investor capital network, et cetera. Why in the world would you stay in that group to syndicate your projects when obviously the most prolific investor and mentor works for that group is doing his syndications elsewhere? Why? Because the grass is greener when you can charge higher syndication fees and have you don't have the handcuffs that you will have if you restrict your syndications to the pond that self-made millionaire has put together. Which, by the way, anytime I say something that you might perceive as negative, I want to say it again. I'm rooting for self-made millionaire. That's where a good chunk of my business comes from, or Dan and my business, you know, the members that join that platform, because they don't hear necessarily all the righteous truth that they would have you to believe. In fact, you will never hear about the option called Realty Mogul or CrowdStreet from that from your education in that group. Let's continue on this discussion about inflation, because this article written by the CIO of Realty Mogul has some telling statistics that explain why inflation. You know, with the goal of avoiding a massive recession during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Fed Reserve began a series of stimulus measures, including the purchase of debt securities. And so they put money into the market through a program known as quantitative easing, which cut the federal the target federal funds rate and push significant amounts of money into the economy. As of February 2022, the central bank had increased the nation's M2 money supply by 40% over the prior 2 years. That's significant. As a result, the Fed Reserve was able to drastically stimulate the demand side of the economy. However, the supply side of the economic equation is a different story. And it wasn't just the pandemic, but simultaneous. And, of course, some of it was the pandemic because of the idiotic shutdown policies that our government deployed, which now, of course, if you look, you know, looking back, some people had pegged it early on that the shutdown was totally unnecessary, but suffice it to say, they weren't the ones running the government. But at the beginning of the pandemic, supply chains worldwide pulled back dramatically. Well, they pulled back because they were being forced to, you know, force employees to get, you know, vaccines, et cetera. So fewer people wanted to work. And, of course, that's not going to be pointed out here in this politically correct article. It was due to expectations of stifled demand, material shortages, shipping, and labor disruptions. Well, guess what? We've had that every year since the beginning of time. I believe you could say you've had assorted combinations of that. Right, Dan? This is just normal living. I mean, you know, now the pandemic's over and we got the rail people that are threatening to strike, and now it's getting ready to be the truckers. You know, I don't know if you've noticed that. Well, okay, well, that's post-pandemic. Pandemic's over, according to the White House. So though demand has since rebounded, many of the disruptions are still factors, because why, Dan? Why? What does the government not understand when you close business after business after business? What's the one practical scenario there that they just have no comprehension of the impact? It's being able to restart, right? They think you can just flip a switch and, oh, everything comes back to normal, right? Well, that's not how it works. And that's what we're seeing, I think, is, you know, you've got fewer employees that are willing to work. You know, that's a big deal. And the resulting imbalance between supply and demand, that depleted inventories created the supply chain bottlenecks, and, you know, became one of the most dramatic drivers of inflation. And then you layer on the energy cost issue, the Russia invasion of Ukraine, which, you know, can't be discounted. Well, yeah, the other thing that can't be discounted is the impact of sanctions that we put on collectively with the EU. And if you'll recall, Dan, it wasn't 4 months ago that I made the prediction those sanctions were going to hurt us worse than the Russian people. And I think that's pretty much been the case, but I guess it's not popular to say it. But in any event, Dan, do you recall here recently how many increases we've had by the Fed on federal funds, on the federal funds rate? In 2022,
it's increased two times at 75 basis points, one time at 50 basis points. So what's that? That's a 2% increase right there. You had 75, 75, 50. That's 2%. I think the total is 3% total.
Yeah, three to three and a quarter. It's five times. The Fed's fund rates increased five times in 2022. To 3 to 3.25 range, the highest level of 15 years.
15 years.
That's right. That's a long time to all of a sudden have the jolt. This year has seen a total increase of 3, so you're right on the mark there. In an effort to curb demand and bring supply and demand back closer to equilibrium, and they are hell-bent. They are nose down, determined to break inflation regardless of what it does, you know, recession-wise and otherwise. And, you know, I think they're following the Volcker or Voigtler policy from back in the early 80s. And I don't know. I mean, I've read where for them to hit their target, it's going to mean losing. We've totally got an unemployment rate. I think it's, what, 6.5% range, Dan, if I remember right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to have to get down to the threes. You're talking millions of jobs that are going to be lost, because that's what's necessary to get the inflation tamed, I guess you might say. So, periods of high inflation, the most important takeaway, I think, on this article is that periods of high inflation tend to affect asset classes differently. And, you know, the comparison between fixed income securities and, of course, rising inflation significantly erodes the purchasing power of those types of investments. For the stock market, you know, high inflation can lead to volatility. I'm sorry. What do you think we're seeing now? Would this qualify as high volatility? I don't know why I can't say that word today. In your book, Dan, what we're seeing right now?
I surely would. You know, yesterday.
I think it might.
I think it definitely will. Market was down big time yesterday. That was after some increases in the last 2 weeks, and all of a sudden it just bottom fell out thanks to that last 0.75% increase in the interest rate. So
yeah, which was forecasted. I thought I had seen it, what, a couple weeks ago when I said, and actually what I had seen was, I guess the Europeans had done it and the U.S. was next or going to be next. During periods of U.S. history when 10-year CPI inflation averaged even just 4% annually, the S&P 500 valuations at the end of those 10-year periods was always at or below historical norms. Real estate, on average, has performed better than other asset classes, and there's a reference here to a 43-year review of the NCREIF Property Index. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm sure you could Google it if you want to read more about it. And it revealed that private real estate returns remain strong even during periods of high inflation and high or medium GDP growth. Unlike traditional fixed income securities, and with generally lower volatility than seen in the stock market, private real estate can offer dynamic cash flows and potential for insulation, which that's where I was headed. It took 37 minutes of the show or 30 two, to basically explain why we continue to review real estate transactions. Our clients continue to invest in them. We invest in them. And, you know, there's certain classes within real estate that might even have other desirability, like, you know, we obviously know that everybody needs a place to lay their head at night. So multifamily apartments have, in the face of significant inflation, there are some changes. There's no question the interest rates have gone up that sponsors have to pay to acquire property. The LTV, or the loan-to-value ratio, has gone down. That's a double whiplash. And yet, that said, there are still transactions out there that are generating really good, or at least pro forma, they're targeting really good returns. Now, you know, you can't lose sight of the fact that if somebody's trying to sell in this market or refinance, they're faced with some of the same onslaught. And so they may lower price a bit to accommodate the underwriting of those that are seeking to buy. So it's an interesting dynamic that's allowing the market to still function and for there still to be a good chance to buy. I saw one transaction this week. We may talk about this tomorrow on the air. I need to see if I've got the document stack yet. I saw a teaser where the syndicator was buying a property at $100,000 a door, Dan, and the comps, valid comps, right in the same neighborhood, were $150,000 a door. So what do you think's going on with that seller? You know, is it likely that maybe they've got a deadline to get a refinance done or some other driver that
maybe... Yeah, their 5-long interest only is due, isn't it?
Well, could be. Could be. Maybe they've already done some extensions. But in any event, historically, I guess if I could sum up one sentence in this article, it's this. Historically, some of the strongest hedges against inflation within real estate can be found in housing, specifically multifamily, student housing, and senior housing. And that's something we've seen, been doing this now for 20-plus years, where we're specifically in, you know, looking at multifamily. And yes, there are peaks, there are valleys. You know, they're not nearly as pronounced, however, as the other options you've got to invest your family's wealth. So we like this particular asset class. Let's turn now, Dan. We talked about how that we were going to interject. Yeah, we started talking about entities last week. We talked about the differences between an LLC and S Corp. And for those of you that missed that, you can go to the KSCBRadio.com podcast page, and you can listen to the show out there. And in any event, the strategy that I wanted to talk about this week involves a trust, a special type of trust. It's even a special type within the special type. Right, Dan? You want to introduce us to the concept of a irrevocable grantor trust?
Irrevocable grantor trust is an entity that can be set up in itself as a tax-paying entity. It has, the trust does not remove any asset from the ownership of the grantor. He still pays taxes. He still pays income taxes, I guess I should say. He still does have instance of a home, his residence, he still owns that house. It may be titled in the name of the trust, but he does still get the allowances for home ownership that you would get for to decrease your property taxes, but yet it would allow for ease of transfer at his death or the death of both people that might might be living there. It is. It might be created then. You would have a life estate, let's call it, in that trust, so that you own it, you live there, you pay taxes on it. It doesn't remove it from your estate. That's a very significant part of this that we need to make sure is understood. It's not a it's a sideways estate planning device, I guess, is something you could say, because it would make for very ease of transfer it when mom and dad are no longer here.
Yeah, and not only that, one of the issues that I didn't hear you mention that I want to be clear about is that the primary residence is still entitled to the Section 121 exclusion if that property is sold. So, you know, the $250,000 or, you know, for single taxpayer versus the $500 for married filing joint exclusion.
And, you know, that is still available, too, because if mom and dad have given these or, you know, included the kids as trust, but yet they're the grantors, mom and dad, if dad dies, which is typically the case, dad dies first, the mom does get a step up in basis that still comes with it.
Yeah.
By the way,
that's not the case generally if you're doing this with a state registered entity such as an LLC, you know, limited partner. Ship or corporation where those exclusions would not be allowable. And then I'm not sure if you mentioned the mortgage interest deduction wouldn't be affected. You know,
well,
it
stays with the grantor, yes. The deduction stays with the grantor. He still pays the taxes. The grantor still pays takes the deductions. You know, usually at this age, you know, when you're talking, I guess, well, you could do a trust transfer when you've got little babies, I guess. But, you know, we generally think of, I do anyway, in the tax planning in the older age group. Perhaps we should get down more to those 25-year-olds, get them early.
Yeah, well, you know, we kind of skipped over the fact that this special trust that we're talking about is irrevocable, and a lot of people think, oh, well, that means we can't change it, and that's not the case. I mean, most irrevocable trusts can be changed if there's agreement, let's just say generally, by those involved. But, you know, if you look at the in the context of this particular trust, you know, this has all the important estate planning functions that revocable living trusts do: probate avoidance, asset management during, you know, grantor, if the grantor becomes incapacitated or institutionalized, it makes it very hard to contest. But however, you know, irrevocable also gives you the shield against creditors for the grantor's property. But, you know, the fact that there's a life estate still lets the grantor have the income and, you know, the ability to, you know, have or keep the asset ownership anonymous. I don't know. There's several things here that I see as part of what we would think of as good asset protection. And, Dan, why don't you discuss just a little bit more about the asset protection via the irrevocability? Summarize that, if you can, just a bit for me. Look at the last part of the discussion I put together on this down towards the bottom.
Oh, they don't have the drink. Are you talking about the blank check?
Basically, right. The grantor does not have that under this structure, which is another wall against creditor claims. So a creditor can't force the grantors to pay a claim. You know, let's say they had a lawsuit involved, and the grantor cannot be forced to pay with financial resources that the grantor does not have the legal capacity to expend. In other words, the corpus, the principal of the trust, is not something that's separate from the income stream. And so since the trust income is accessible to the grantor, then claimants could reach that part of the trust. On the other hand, because that's part of the life interest, but the big money, the golden eggs, the principal assets of the trust would not be something that could be touched. And so, you know, this form of trust, and we're going to talk about other trusts, and this is a relatively simple one in that it's a single tier. You know, we have other strategies that we employ that are multiple tiers of either LLCs or trust, and we'll get into more of those at a high level on future shows as we talk more and more about the entities that you have choices of with respect to your real estate investing. And you know, when you're a let's say you're a professional couple, both of you work, you've got, you know, two W-2s, and you're making reasonably good money, and you're out there investing in these real estate private syndications, just, you know, investing them in your own name. You know, there's no structure. You're pretty much naked to the concept that if you accidentally have a car accident on the way home that, God forbid, injures, maims, or kills someone, those ownership interests can be owned by somebody else at the end of that lawsuit. And that's something that you really ought to think about, because a lot of our clients, their net worth is pretty much tied up in these types of investments. And yet there's multiple angles that you've got to consider that. If you put the wrong entity type in place, you may not be, like, for instance, an LLC in this case, if we're talking about two high net worth individuals or high income earning individuals, you know, they both would have to qualify for accredited investor status to invest in LLC if it's a non-disregarded LLC. So, you know, it becomes, on the one hand, you're doing something good for asset protection, and maybe you block the ability to have, you know, investments that are for accredited investors. The beauty about the grantor trust is that as long as each grantor is accredited, which husband and wife probably would be by virtue of the married filing joint status and non-separate LLC owner status, then this strategy should pass muster on, you know, being able to continue to invest in certainly the 506C type of investment, and for certain you could still invest as a sophisticated investor under 506B. So, you know, it's not just tax planning, it's not just asset protection, it's not just asset management. There's a number of perspectives that we've got to consider each time we look at putting one of these transactions together. Dan, we've got about 5 minutes left, 6 minutes. Do you have anything you want to add here, or do you want to compare this to any other style besides just doing things in your own personal name?
Liability is the big thing that we talk a lot about, and I think that's one of the big things of an LLC, limited liability company. Maybe you need to be looking at this trust for the same reason, because you might be able to piece out part of an investment to a lower tax paying person within your trust group, let's call it. You know, maybe there's some grandchildren that are going to go to college one day, and you could possibly put some money out to them through the trust if that's allowable or would be agreeable to the parents of that grandchild. you know, something like that could be very beneficial from a long-term planning standpoint. You know, even life insurance could be bought in that trust. You know, specifically, sometimes we talk about a irrevocable life insurance trust. This one, could it buy the life insurance as well for that, maybe even for that child? You know, start buying insurance, life insurance. I'm talking about whole life or life insurance that's not term insurance, and to for this child, maybe for when he's 65 years old, he could have a pretty nice pot of gold out there, you know, many years hence, if that life insurance is bought right and paid for right over those years. I mean, that's just
that's true. And of course, there's other charitable strategies, maybe not even within this type of trust, that could be put in play as well, that would also provide certain asset protection as well as tax. I mean, in this case, the grantors are going to be the only tax return that gets filed. This special type of irrevocable grantor trust will not file its own tax return even. It'll still be the grantor. While it's a separate legal entity, I guess it's not a separate tax entity. So the only pass-through, if there's, the incidence of taxation pass-through, like off of K-1s, would pass through directly to the grantor or grantors.
Can it not own an LLC itself? I mean, that grantor decides he wants to buy or own a multifamily property. He's got the cash to do it. He's got the accreditation to do it.
I think you could. I'd have to think through some of the logic on accredited investor status. Again, that's something that, you know, most of our clients would find important. And I have not. I don't think we've got anybody that's used one of these trusts to acquire or to form an LLC that has the LLC go invest in the assets, because that would take, a $5 million net worth to qualify as accredited. So we like to stay within that easier hurdle of $1 million, which, again, as long as the grantors had that level, this would allow you to invest. And I'm not sure, beyond maybe a different tax allocation, I don't know that there would be any more asset protection achieved by doing that within an LLC, if you could even put it in one of these trusts. But, you know, we'll talk about maybe next week. I've got a summary that I started a while back as to the reasons why, quote, everyone needs a trust. And it's not necessarily this kind of trust, but there are so many different types of trust out there that fit different unique circumstances. I'll see if I can wrap that in progress discussion up, and maybe we can talk about that next week, because it is amazing, even in the face of the Build Back Better Act, which was taking aim at a lot of the family trust planning vehicles, how there's still significant flexibility and you know, the outcomes are still significant enough to go through the headache of putting trust together. One thing I want to mention that we didn't really talk much about last week when we talked about the differences between LLCs and S-Corps is that, you know, we talk about these entities on the air, and we don't really drill down and talk about one of the most important things regardless of what entity or planning structure you're thinking about. And, you know, it's something that we do. Dan, what might that be that tends to get overlooked in the discussion of all these wonderful strategies that most people don't keep up with, and then they become problematic? You know what I'm referring to?
No, I'm sorry.
How about accounting for the entities and keeping
that was
the separate.
Too easy. I thought you was getting something deeper than that.
I was just talking. I said it's very basic, and I'm going to tell you right now, if you don't like keeping up with your financial reporting, both internally to your other constituents within the trust or the LLC or whoever, and external. It's very, very difficult to plan. It makes planning very difficult when we don't have up-to-the-minute financial data to tell you whether to turn left or right. So that's something that we do. It doesn't have to be horribly expensive because most of these entities are not heavy, intense level of transactions. And so, we have the ability using automated bank feeds and other technology to where we can do, turn counting around fairly quickly. And I would just suggest to you that if you're not interested in keeping up with the financial reporting, I would not do any trust or any LLC or any other entity because the reporting requirements will smother you, basically, if you don't have, cumulative historical data. That's the key, cumulative historical data. Because that's what it takes for filing most of the tax returns. Well, Dan, we're already at the end of the show this week. It's hard to believe. And so I appreciate you joining us. I hope all the listeners will join in tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. when we talk syndication math. And I'll see if I can't find a couple of live deals that we can talk about on the air. So we look forward to having you tune in tomorrow at 7 a.m. right here on KSCV AM 700.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEV.